Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. It is Thursday, April 3rd, 2003. We are continuing the public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Health Services, and it is the Medical Assistance Program and their budget presentation. Just housekeeping. The standard, if there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, please make sure you turn it off so that we don't disrupt the proceedings. And also, for those of you who haven't been to our proceedings before, we do have with us Little Rosie and Big Rosie. And Little Rosie and Big Rosie, in some respects, loves to hear acronyms, because when they hear acronyms, it means that you have to pay up. And the dollars that are being accumulated in Big Rosie and Little Rosie will, at the end of session, will be contributed to the Oregon Food Bank to assist them as they feed the hunger that come to the various banks around the state. So with that, and I know that yesterday Lynn Reed, who was with the Administrator for for Medical Assistance Program, decided that she would probably be prolific in using acronyms, so she ponied up in advance, and Rosie thanks you. Mr. Britton, if you do you have anything? Yeah. Let's wait till the rest of them arrive. If not, I know that Barry Cass is ready, and I know that Lynn's ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Barry Cast, Assistant Director for Health Services. We will continue on page 22 with the agenda that we began yesterday for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs.
And I'm Lim Reed, Administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And yesterday we finished up basically setting the stage in terms of what traditional Medicaid is, the waivers, what led us to the Oregon Health Plan, and then on to the Oregon Health Plan 2, and just kind of the waivers that we have from federal regulations that allow us to operate our program in a different way from what would normally be required of a state Medicaid program. Today I want to start with some discussion about what our program looks like today. Leave the history of how we got here at this point. I also want to mention that I have invited Dr. Lyle Jackson, who is the medical director from the Mid-Rogue IPA Managed Healthcare Plan, to come and provide some insight to the committee in terms of what it's like, what the Oregon Health Plan means to a community. And he'll be joining us sometime, I would say, around 1:30 or so. And so I'll stop at an appropriate time to allow him to come up and speak with you. But back to page 22. Today's program, first I wanted to start off with who we cover, and we spent quite a bit of time yesterday talking about the various categories of people who are eligible for Medicaid. And in our program in Oregon, we do cover the traditional Medicaid categories, the aged, blind, disabled, pregnant women, children under age 19, children in foster care, TANF families. We also have our expansion populations that we talked about briefly yesterday. These are Oregon residents who meet financial and eligibility criteria but don't fit in the traditional categories. They're adults ages 19 through 64. And the Children's Health Insurance Program, and insured children under age 19 who do not meet the Medicaid categories of eligibility. On page 23, we also cover some groups of Medicaid clients who are not considered part of the Oregon Health Plan. Yesterday we did mention the medically needy program, which is no longer covered. I just don't want to let them be forgotten, and so I've noted them here. We cover something called qualified Medicare beneficiaries. These are Medicare clients who have income below 100% of the poverty level. And for those clients, we will pay for their Medicare Part B premiums, their Medicare coinsurance and deductible, And some of these individuals may also qualify in our regular traditional long-term care or old age assistance program or aid to the disabled. There's another group of Medicare beneficiaries called specified low-income Medicare beneficiaries. And this is a group of higher-income Medicare clients from 100 to 135% of the poverty level. And for this group, we provide the Medicare Part B premium. That's a benefit worth about, it's probably around $59 per person per month.
Madam Chair?
Representative Bates.
I was going to ask this question. Thank you for bringing up these specified low-income Medicare beneficiaries. Run that past me just real quick again.
They have income between 100 and 135% of the poverty level, and the benefit to which they're entitled is payment of their Medicare Part B premium. And this is a group, this is a mandated group. It's actually broken into two groups. From 100 to 120% of the poverty level, the state puts up its share of the Medicaid dollars. So we pay 40 cents on the dollar. The feds pay 60 cents. For those between 120 and 135% of the poverty level, the federal government actually reimburses the state 100%.
Well, that makes sense.
Which doesn't make sense.
Madam Chair, can I ask?
A follow-up.
As my head is sitting here spinning, you know. For individuals less than 100% of the federal poverty level, I would imagine they're on Medicaid altogether.
When we turn to the next page, I'll show you some income levels and speak to that issue. Generally speaking, they're around 75 to 78% of the poverty level are have full Medicaid coverage. And so there is a gap on up to 100% where individuals Medicare clients would only have, unless they meet an exception, which I'll talk about in a moment, they would only have the Medicare Part B premium paid by us and the coinsurance and deductible, Medicare coinsurance and deductible. They wouldn't have wraparound Medicaid services between about 75% and 100% of poverty.
But we would cover Part B for
mm-hmm.
that.
And Part B is about, is 59?
Yeah, it's around $59. Mm-hmm. And I think we, for the 0305 biennium, I think we're estimating a little over 77,000 people that we'll be paying the Medicare Part B premium for.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
My memory is that's about that was in a group of $46 million at one point of state funds.
Is that the breast cancer?
And the breast cancer is in that, but that's a real small piece of it. So that $46 million nut we saw before, is that primarily in this group?
Yes. The $46 million is exactly for the qualified Medicare beneficiaries and the specified low-income Medicare beneficiaries. That particular amount of money does not cover the, it does. The breast and cervical cancer program is a very small amount of money, so it's a rounding error in the $46 million. There are only about 100 people in that program.
Follow-up.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. If we it's just to see the other side of the coin, if we chose not to pay the Part B for people at or above 100% of the poverty level for these Medicare patients, they would have Part A Medicare, potentially wouldn't have Part B, but how would that impact the state financially if they didn't have Part B?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, might impact us very dramatically because they're a mandated group. We don't have that option.
Oh, it's a mandate.
Yeah, if we want to draw down the federal dollars, we have to cover these groups.
You don't have it. You have it in the non-OHP categories.
Yeah, it's non-OHP, but it is mandated for Medicaid.
For Lynn, you may want to explain, because Representative Bates and I and others talk on this panel, and we forget that there are other people that don't know when you're talking
nuts.
Part A and Part B, and they're talking the Social Security Act and retirement.
Gosh.
There are two pieces to it, and the B piece is that it pays for doctors. Does not pay for prescription. So you need to know that, you know, Part B does not include prescriptions.
Yeah.
It will include physicians, but none. The federal government does not pay for prescriptions. So I need to clarify that so that my new members don't you know, would not know, and that's why I wanted this 101 course so that they understand the distinction. So what basically Lynn is saying is that Oregon is picking up the Part B premiums, because when you become chronologically advantaged, 65, and you sign up for Social Security, they, you know, most people think that when you get Social Security that all this stuff is covered. It is not true. And they say, do you want to pay, do you want to be in Part B? So you tell them yay or nay, and that's that premium that she's talking about.
Thank you. That was helpful, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you turn to the next page, page 24, it's just a graphic display of the various federal poverty levels that our programs go up to. And I'll have to explain those acronyms at the bottom. I don't think the paper can pay its quarter there to Rosie. The TANF program is the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, and goes up to about 50% of the federal poverty level. The next bar over is poverty level medical women, and those are pregnant women, and they go up to 185% of the federal poverty level in terms of our coverage. The next group over is poverty level medical children, and these are children, there are actually two groups of children in that bar. Children under age 6 go up to 133% of the federal poverty level. Children under age 19 go up to 100% of the federal poverty level. Then the next two groups that are labeled families and adult couples, these are the expansion population, the 100,000 or so individuals that have eligibility just because we started the Oregon Health Plan back in 1994. And that currently goes up to 100% of the federal poverty level. Then the next two groups are old age assistants, seniors age 65 and above, and aid to the blind, aid to the disabled persons. And they're in that, the percentage varies a little bit, but in the 75 to 78% of the federal poverty level. Now, the exception to that is that for those individuals who have need of long-term care services, and if they meet the long-term care criteria that the department is currently funding, those are the priority levels that have recently been cut back. For those individuals, though, who are in priority levels that we still cover, their income can be three times this amount and qualify for the long-term care coverage and for the wraparound Medicaid full benefit coverage. So it can go up to around 220% of the poverty level for those. And then the last bar is the Children's Health Insurance Program, which goes up to 185% of the poverty level.
Next, Madam Chair.
Representative Weston.
Lynn, do we have a companion graph someplace in this, or can we get one easily that would actually show the monies expended for each category? I think that would be very helpful to a lot of members, you know, just to put it, you know, side by side so you can see relative, you know, to what the category it is, to how much money we're spending. Because, you know, children goes way up there, and I know we spend a lot more, relatively speaking, than this on long-term care, and I think that would be, you know, good to show the members. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, we can put that together for you.
And then when you do the breakout, break it out when you come to the children six,
right,
the six of age and the 19, so that we...
I will do that as well, or staff will do that. Page 25. Staff are laughing. It wasn't the royal we.
Lynn?
Yes.
On the old age assistance, many of those people, or I'm presuming most all of them, are covered by Medicare first, and then this is kind of a wraparound coverage?
Madam Chair, Mr. Britton, yes, this is a wraparound coverage. Old age assistance, I think more than 95% of those individuals have Medicare coverage, and Medicare is the primary payer. For the aid to the blind, aid to the disabled group, There are, I'm estimating now, about 40% probably have Medicare coverage and the rest do not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Lynn, on the old age assistance population, that's 75% of the federal poverty level, is that correct, or thereabouts?
Yes.
And the standard population excludes people over 64. So help me through this. Do we have 25% of elderly people below the federal poverty level who do not have wraparound services?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that is basically correct. A part of the policy discussion when the Oregon Health Plan was originally set up was trying to look at what the state could afford and taking the position that Medicare coverage was some coverage, even though it wasn't completely a comprehensive coverage. And so the decision at that point was made not to include those folks in the families, adults, couples.
As a policy situation, we could have people in their 40s and 50s and 30s who had wraparound services at less than the federal poverty, 100% of the federal poverty level, and yet a person who's 83 years old has no chance of working and can't get anything more could be in a situation at the same level with no benefits for the Oregon Health Plan other than their Medicare benefits. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's correct. They would have their Medicare benefits, assuming we're talking about the 75% to 100%
yes.
group. They would have their Medicare benefits. We would pay for their Medicare Part B premium. We would pay their Medicare deductibles and coinsurance. And previously, before the medically needy program was eliminated, there was the possibility that if they had high medical costs that they incurred that would bring their income down, that they could qualify for a wraparound benefit of drugs and mental health and chemical dependency in that program. But that program only had about 8,500 people in it.
Madam Chair,
follow up.
Yeah, this just seems a gap. This seems like a bad piece of policy to me, and I just want to make sure I'm clear on it because I'm sure it'll come up in discussions other places. That 25%, What size of a population is that, if you know? We're primarily talking, of course, about a pharmaceutical benefit for them. That's what most of them don't have. That's what they need. And so I'd like to know if we could find out, and I don't want you spending a week on this because you're actually getting hammered by seven different committees. What does that 25% look like? Are a lot of them in the medically needy program? Are a few in the medically needy program? Is there a huge number out there? We're looking at the potential for trying to find a way to get to a senior drug benefit. It would seem to me the most likely place to go is to those people below the federal poverty level who are seniors who have Medicare and no pharmaceutical benefit and do it through a federal match. I mean, it seems like a logical place to go here, but there may be something I'm missing, which is not unusual. Okay?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we will see what we can pull together there. Are you only interested in the seniors in that income range, or are you also interested in persons with disabilities?
Both.
Could you give us both?
Yes.
But give us, separate them out and give us both?
Thank you.
On page 25, just wanted for your information to provide you with a chart showing what the federal poverty levels were. As an example, I could walk you through a family of three. The family could have income up to $1,272 a month, and that's gross income. And the adults could qualify for the OHP benefit package. The family could have higher income, as high as $2,353 a month, and have the children qualify for our benefit package, although the adults wouldn't qualify. And if one adult was in a pregnant woman, she would qualify at the higher level until 2 months after delivery of the baby.
That's under our current.
And that's the way our current program works. All of what I'm talking about right now is the program as it exists today. And the federal poverty levels go up. It's driven by the federal government. They go up every year, and sometime during the month of February. The most recent increase, which just happened last month, If you looked at 100% of the poverty level, one person, it went up by $10. So they're not big increases on an annual basis. Moving to page 26, although this display has a few problems with it, what we intended to do was to provide you with some eligibility numbers in the various eligibility groups over time, so you could see how eligibility has changed. Yeah, we go from 1995-97 biennium through our current authority and an estimate of what 03-05 would be. There's definitely a problem in the line with the poverty level children in that all those numbers should just shift to the left so that 71,931 kids belongs in the 95-97 column. And each number shifts to the left one. And you can see over time, looking down at the bottom, in terms of how the program eligibility caseload has changed, starting off in 95-97 at the 395,000 level, we dropped in 97-99, and some of this was the result of the welfare reform activities and more emphasis in terms of assisting people in getting jobs. And then the program continued to grow since then, on up to 397,000 last biennium, estimated 450,000 this biennium, and then estimated 480,000 in 03-05. I will make one comment. There was one group of eligibles that wasn't included here, so if this is a number year, isn't what you expected to see. The citizen alien waived emergency medical individuals aren't on this graph, and for 03-05, that's about, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 22,000 folks, which brings the eligibles on up to around 500,000.
22,000?
Yes.
You were going to get some additional information for us on that one, weren't you?
I don't recall what that particular piece of information was.
From our work group. I'll need to go
back to
my notes.
I'll get back to you with you afterwards.
Again, well, I think we wanted the cost.
I think the cost.
We wanted analysis of the cost, who, what, and because I think some of the discussions we had that generally a lot of them was in the pregnant women category.
Right.
But we wanted those categorized.
We have that information. We provided that to Representative Westland's committee. And so that information is readily available, and we'll bring that back.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Question. Are these the 480,000 estimated, are those persons that are actually enrolled in the program or eligible for a program?
Unfortunately, usually use the term eligibles to mean enrolled in the program, participants.
Okay.
Although in this case it's an estimate for 03-05, but that's what we mean. We mean participants. There would be more who are actually eligible but haven't joined. On page 27, there's just a demographic breakout of our client population as of January of this year, showing that, about 46% of our clients are under age 19, so they'd be in the children categories. 37% are probably what you call in the childbearing years up to age 50. Then we've got 8.6% that are in the age 50 to 64 before they're eligible for Medicare, and then 8.8% of the population that's age 65 and above. And that population is growing as the general population ages.
So if we looked at baby boomers, we're 10 years out, we're in some...
Right, I'm already in that 6.7% line and moving my way up. And then the other chart that's on that page is a race ethnicity chart that goes with the population as a whole. Once again, it's a snapshot of January 03, showing the distribution. I did do, when we had prepared this information, this is based on January, I did have access to March, and I looked to see whether or not it had changed a bit. And what I noticed was that for the Hispanic population, it actually showed in a two-month time period an increase of 0.6%. So I think there is some fluctuation in these percentages, depending upon what time of year it may be. The next set of charts I've included, because there's been a lot of discussion about the what's called the OHP standard or the expansion population, the 100,000 eligibles. And so I've got several charts in here that talk about that population so you can get a sense of who they are.
Are these categories?
No.
No, these are this is the population that is only eligible because of the Oregon Health Plan waivers that we have.
Okay.
And this is the group that in discussions appears to be somewhat vulnerable in terms of having to make hard choices with available revenue, and so I thought you'd like to have a little more information on that particular group. The chart on page 28 takes that total 100,000 or so eligibles and is a division by age, sex. And about 54% of the population is female, and it varies a bit depending upon what age range you're in. That last set of bars, the 60 to 69 set, is so small because the program really only goes up through age 64, so it only represents a five-year group of individuals. The next page, page 29, also looks at age, sex, but it looks at a subset of the individuals on the previous page. And this is that portion of the population that has children in the household. And we've discovered that those with children in the household and those without are very different in terms of their health care needs and the composition of the families, and that's why I've broken them out for you. Here with children in the household, 64% are female, and a heavy distribution in the childbearing ages like you would expect to see. On the next page, page 30, there are the adults without children in the household. I'm sorry.
Lynn, are the 60 to 69, are these the grandparents of children?
I think probably they are. But they definitely do have children in the household that are participating in the Medicaid program. And so in many cases, those would be grandparents.
It looks like a higher number of male
yes.
than female.
I can't explain why, but I did note that as well.
You mean
50-59 too?
Yeah. Grandpa stepping up to the plate. That's what that.
So after 50,
like.
We start being responsible citizens.
Exactly.
I'm there.
On page 30, this is the subset of the population that doesn't have children in the household, and now it is somewhat disproportionate male. 53% are male, and you can see that. You know, that holds pretty much until you get up to the age 60. Until you get up to age 50. And then there's a switch in terms of more females participating in the program. The next page gets to the income distribution for this 100,000 eligibles. This first chart on page 31 is the entire 100,000. And you'll see that just under 40% of that group has income below 10% of the poverty level, and that pretty much means zero. It was just we went in 10% increments, so I couldn't get down to what zero is. But it's very different among the two subsets in terms of those with children in the household and those without. The next page, 32, shows that difference. In the under 10% of the poverty level, those it's labeled here singles, couples, adults. Those are without children in the household. Are over 50% of that population group. And those with children in the household are below 20% in that income range. The next chart in the book is at page 33. And this also is a snapshot in time. It was November of 2002. And what we wanted to do was provide you with some information in terms of how people participating in our program are spread across the state. And it's not the same same participation in every county. As you might expect, some counties are do better than other counties in terms of the availability of jobs. And if you look at the far right-hand column, this is for a combination of our Medicaid clients and our Children's Health Insurance Program clients. And I'll just focus on a couple of them. And this is a percentage of our clients as a percentage of the population in the county. So Benton and Clackamas counties have just around 7% of their population participating in our program. When you move down to and Washington County, it's also around 7%. The high participation areas, the two J's there, Jefferson and Josephine counties, are over 18% of the population is participating in the program. And then just a, you know, a couple of middle of the road, around 13% or so, Jackson County, Linn County, Marion County, Multnomah. And the column right next to it is a distribution of the dollars. And so it gives you a sense of the dollars that accompany those eligibles and that for the most part are expended in the general vicinity for health care needs for those individuals. At this point, that concludes what I was going to talk about the eligibles. And before we move to a discussion about cover benefits, which Jim Edge is going to...
You might want to... This is a monthly expenditure.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Jim Edge will be talking about cover benefits shortly, but at this point in time, I understand that... Dr. Jackson has joined us, and for those of you who weren't here in the beginning when I mentioned that Dr. Lyle Jackson, who is the medical director for the Mid-Rogue IPA health plan, has agreed to come and talk and share with you some of the experiences of operating the Oregon health plan in a community setting and what the Oregon health plan means to the community. So with that, Dr. Jackson.
Dr. Jackson, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate being here, being invited to come here. As was just mentioned, Josephine County, along with Jefferson County, is one of the two highest or the two poorest counties in the state. And I know OMAP mentioned, I think Dr. John Santa mentioned several months ago that at one time it was at that time, it was 21% of people in Josephine County at that moment were in the Oregon Health Plan. The state also has provided information that at one time or another over 5 years, up to 38% of people in Josephine County participated in the Oregon Health Plan. And that's a huge amount of, in terms of sheer numbers. Let me backtrack a little bit and tell you who I am. I'm a family practice doctor. I moved to Josephine County in 1977 from the Midwest, my residency program. And so I've participated in the primary care setting in the Rogue Valley for a relatively long period of time. And I have seen personally for patients of mine who have been on the Oregon Health Plan through not necessarily any fault of their own, received obviously good care, and then have, through hard work, have gone on and become very successful. And I think it's very important for people to realize that people in the Oregon Health Plan are on and off the plan all the time. And it's really a safety net program for the neediest people of the county. I'm also the medical director of our safety net clinic, Siskiyou Clinic, which started originally in Cave Junction and now has two campuses in Grants Pass and in Cave Junction. And they are, by their mission statement, is to take care of people who don't have insurance. And these are the people who are not necessarily in the Oregon Health Plan, but are people who have are self-pay or actually no insurance. And in our county, it's estimated to be up to 20%. And with the disappearance of the standard population from the Oregon Health Plan, that's going to increase that even more. The Oregon Health Plan in Josephine County has been very successful. And the reason why it's been successful is because the doctors have bought into it. And I think that may be out of necessity because so many people in Josephine County, which has approximately a draw of about 80,000 people, so many people do participate in the Oregon Health Plan. It's obviously a major player in the health care benefits of the county. And in Josephine County, we have the IPA, Mid-Rogue IPA, makes up approximately three-fourths of the doctors, and we have virtually 100% participation. The other 25% is made up by the Grants Pass Clinic, a multi-specialty clinic, and that has their own Oregon Health Plan. And plus, we have a minor participation by family care in this area. And the reason why I think the Oregon Health Plan works there is because the doctors live in the community and they see these people. These are our neighbors. I have personal friends who've been on the Oregon Health Plan. If you live in a relatively small town like Grants Pass, where I live, you don't make that distinction. And we also recognize you've been practicing in any of these areas for a while. People may be in the Oregon Health Plan for a while, then they may have Blue Shield, Blue Cross, and they may have no insurance. But as Dr. Bates could probably tell you, you take care of these people. You don't take care of them because they're on the Oregon Health Plan or not on the Oregon Health Plan. They live in your community. You live in the community. You buy groceries for them. You see them in churches. You see them on trails. They fix your car. They supply wood for you for your fireplace. Did I barter because people didn't have money? Sure, you barter. And that's part of practicing in Oregon. So the doctors, at least in our community, have bought into it. And as a result of that, there's good access for the Oregon Health Plan for people to participate in. And part of the reason for that, it has to do with part of the buy-in for doctors to participate in the Oregon Health Plan is they have to be compensated to keep their doors open. And under a fully capitated plan, they have the ability to do that because there's a risk involved. And when there's a risk, when the plan takes a risk, there's also a chance to make profit. And as a result, the profit is poured back into the compensation for the doctors to make it allowable for them to see these patients. And in areas where you may not have that, it's harder for the doctors to participate in it because the compensation is relatively low. And people, the doctors who have obviously bills to pay, insurance to pay, salaries to pay, can't afford to see these patients. So the Oregon Health Plan is a mechanism to compensate physicians at a level so they can see these patients and still keep a door open.
Well, Doctor, I want to thank you for coming up here. I know it's take a day off your practice and drive up here to see us is difficult. I think you've been very, very modest about what the people and the physicians and the community in Grants Pass have done. You've put together a program in a rural part of the state with one of the heaviest loads of OHP patients imaginable, 18%. That's almost one in four for you people. You've ran a capitated program, good access for patients, been very careful with the money, controlled your pharmaceutical costs, your hospitalization utilization through very tight, carefully controlled programs, and I think it's a lot of extra effort. I think the rest of the state had followed your lead uniformly, we'd be much better off. We've used you and other programs as a model for where we want to go with the program. And I thank you for your hard work all these years, and thanks for coming up to date, too.
I appreciate it, Representative Bates. I think one of the reasons why it works is it's relatively local control. We're relatively small. We know our people. They know us. The doctors know me. I know them. There's a real sense of cooperation between the doctors, the hospital, and social agencies. And I think this is where being relatively small does have its efficiency and cost savings that you can't have in a big system, at least on the medical part of it.
John?
I have another comment or question, Dr. Bates.
I could say they've done a great job down there, and I'm a little embarrassed my county hasn't done as well, but we're working to catch up to you. We're having a meeting this week.
Appreciate that.
Well, we, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Curiosity, how does the reimbursement under OHP compare to Medicare as a percent of your normal charges?
I could tell you, you know, like an open card. You're talking about what percentage of doctors have Oregon Health Plan or just the fee schedule?
Just your fee schedule. My concern is that we're lowering the reimbursements
right.
for providers to the point where we'll...
And that's the concern for physicians, not only Medicare, but also not only the Medicaid side of it, but also mm-hmm. Medicare. And as you know, recently they have leased... decided not to cut that anymore, at least for this coming year. I could say the commercial, if you know what RVUs are, is relative mm-hmm. value units, commercials, insurance pay approximately somewhere between $55 to $60 per RVUs now. Medicare probably is somewhere around $36 for the same value. Under the open card model, where there's not a managed care, it's approximately $26, and where we pay our physicians is $31. But our physicians have because they're at risk, there's a 10% withhold. So in the years when we don't make any money, they lose 10%. But most years we do make some money. And you include that money that the physicians not only get their withhold back, they get a chance, if there's any profit, we give it back to the physicians, to our stockholders. And you add that to the relative value, it's probably close to $40. So it's probably actually better than the Medicare. And that's what makes, to be honest with you, that's part of the buy-in for physicians to participate in the Oregon Health Plan. And I think... comparison to representative basis community where they don't have that, it's harder for doctors to buy into it because you can't cover your overhead for $26.
Follow up.
Thank you. On the insured plans, fully insured plans, what would be your RVU?
The
dollar per RVU.
Around 55
to
60. And you're talking about HMOs, talking about PPOs.
Right.
It's relatively, but it's somewhere in the mid to high 50s, I would say now.
Thank you.
I think where you're going is the disparity in what the fully insured, and then you get to the Medicaid, and then you get to the Medicare.
Well, it's just a continuation of the cost shifting.
Right.
And we drive that.
Yeah.
I think it's important.
Absolutely.
I think it's important for the legislatures to know that doctors don't participate in the Oregon Health Plan to make money. They do it because it's a ethical, community responsible thing to do. It's part of being a physician, and I think physicians don't look upon the compensation for the Oregon Health Plan to be anywhere near what it would be for people who have gold nuggets and commercial insurance. But you have to reach a certain threshold to make it so they're not losing money. And I think where we live, where we also have a heavy Medicare population where there's decrease in reimbursement for that population, is putting a lot of pressure on physicians to even practice, and it does affect our recruiting and finding doctors to come to that area because of the relatively high percentage of Medicare and Medicaid in our population.
Madam Chair.
President, thanks.
I'm going to direct this to Senator Morris, I think, more than anybody else. He's brought up a very important point in this entire program, and that is this. We do contribute to that cost shift, and we've estimated anywhere from 25% to 40% of the extra premium you're paying on the commercial side is because of Medicaid and Medicare cost shift. And if we are unable to fund the standard population, we will make that cost shift worse, because a lot of that cost shift is a result of not drawing down that 60-40 match from the federal government, and we'll be taking about $1 billion out of Oregon in health care and leaving it at the table in Washington, D.C. And I would expect that there's not a hospital that's going to close or a doctor's going to close, although some may move, but those patients will still be seen, unfortunately, and that pressure against the commercial carriers, against businessmen who have to fund that, is going to be just unbearable, just about unbearable.
Senator Morris.
In addition to that, as an example from a hospital perspective, the deductions from revenue in the Albany General Hospital are running 40% to 42%, and the Samaritan Health Service, as a system, we're in the mid to high 30s. So that gives you an idea of the magnitude of the cost shift in order to wind up making a 1.5% to 2% operating margin to put dollars back in for improving medical equipment and care. So it's a balance that is very tenuous.
Absolutely.
We have the hospital board of directors over here and the doc over here, just so that you know.
And we're agreeing.
And they're agreeing.
Who?
Continue. Dr. Jackson, and we are pleased that you took the time to drive up to Salem to share with us and to testify. We are concerned about the issue of cost shift, but also the whole issue of access. And I think, you know, that this panel would like to make sure we do have doctors there, and we appreciate all that you're giving to your community and to the state.
Well, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cordley.
In the previous discussion, I would just like to note in Senator Carter's absence that we had three RVUs and one PPO. I'll make that contribution on behalf of Dr. Jackson.
Thank you.
Dr. Jackson, you were not here. We have a policy here that when one uses acronyms, and Senator Gordley has graciously to do it on your behalf, Rosie, who you saw before you, the two pigs and the piglet, collects money that is going to be donated to the Oregon Food Bank from this committee. So she thanks you for all of your acronyms.
It's certainly a fine idea.
Madam Chair, at this time, Jim Edge has joined me. Jim is the Acting Assistant Administrator at the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and Jim's going to move on and talk about moving into today's program, what is covered, the benefits that are covered under the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid. Jim.
And, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I think I'll go ahead and make my repayment. I don't think I can go all the way through a presentation without at least a few acronyms. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Edge. As Lynn already said, I'm the Acting Assistant Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the benefit packages and services under the Oregon Health Plan. I'm on page 34 of this document that we call Medicaid 101. I'll start first with the Oregon Health Plan Plus benefit package. That's the relatively comprehensive package of services based on the prioritized list of health services The PLUS benefit package includes medical, dental, mental health, chemical dependency services, and it focuses on preventive care. Clients are assigned to the PLUS benefit package if they meet the traditional Medicaid categorical requirements. Lynn talked about those a few minutes ago, and they're on page 26 of this document if you want to refer back to those. Some of these clients are charged nominal copayments on outpatient services and prescription drugs. Those are the $2 and $3 copayments, and there's a number of clients who are accepted from those copayments, primarily clients in managed care plans and also some pregnant women and children. Then there's the Oregon Health Plan Standard Benefit Package. This is the benefit package that was developed for the implementation of Oregon Health Plan 2, which went into effect in February 1st of this year. This is a reduced benefit package, which was designed initially to be similar to private insurance. Covered services under the standard benefit package are based on the prioritized list overlaid by another list of a defined set of benefits. And the standard package requires more and higher copayments than the PLUS benefit package, as well as monthly premiums. And in a few minutes, I'll get into some more specifics about what those are. Some other benefit packages under the Oregon Health Plan are the institutional and long-term care services. These are traditionally Medicaid benefits, although in Oregon they're administered primarily through seniors and people with disabilities, and you'll be hearing more specifics about these when that group comes to testify before you. There's the benefit package that's provided to the Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical Assistance clients, and these clients are not citizens. Lynn mentioned them a few minutes ago. And they do not have an immigration status that might give them the full benefit package. Their coverage is limited to emergency service only. And, in fact, the vast majority of the services they received is deliveries. And finally, there's the Qualified Medicare Beneficiary Benefit Package. And we talked about that a few minutes ago, too. This package covers clients who also receive Medicare benefits. And for clients qualifying for this package, we pay their Medicare Part B premiums, deductibles, and coinsurance. On the next page, page 36.
Senator Moore.
Excuse me for interrupting. Sure. I'd like to go back to the nominal copayments.
Sure.
I've had some pushback from physicians with respect to this being just another cost shift, and I guess the question to Dr. Bates would be your perception of this new rule. It was implemented, I think, in February, or it came out just recently, that the ability to manage these graduated copays through just the normal process of seeing a patient when you don't know exactly what you're going to be ordering winds up being a shift to the physician, because the physician is not really in a position to stop the exam and say, we need a copay. And I don't know whether that is something
I'll give you,
Dr. Bates, but
I'll give you my experience on it for what's worth. As you know, I argued from the very beginning that copays at the doctor's office for seeing a physician were appropriate and an excellent method of helping control utilization. And our experience, my 18 doctor group has been good at collecting that copay. So they've stepped up. The patients have actually wanted, been eager to pay it, with the exception of one person in the last 3 months. The problem has been what you're talking about is the copays on trying to collect copays for X-ray and lab. That is something I argued against in the beginning, but you just can't do it. You don't know what you're ordering ahead of time. You don't know how to collect it ahead of time. The service is already rendered. And secondly, it becomes something that's onerous for the patients. They are glad to pay a $3 or $5 copay to see the physician. They see that as a responsibility. The rest of it's very difficult for them, and that has become a caution. I think you're right. Under the health plans, it's probably covered better because they're capitated, so it's not a big problem.
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, I might point out, too, that what we're talking about on page 34 is the nominal copayments on the plus population, and that actually is a set of copayments that was directed by the last legislative session that our program began collecting. On the plus benefit package, on the mandatory clients or the categorical clients that are provided services, the federal government requires that those be nominal, and in general that means under $3, and that they be what's called voluntary, which means that the provider can't refuse to provide the service strictly for the inability of the client to pay the copayment. But there is a different set of copayments for the standard clients, and I'll get into the details of that in just a minute. And those are higher copayments, and probably is more what you're referring to when you talk about the cost shift that can occur from a client not paying those copayments. But these are small copayments that were actually directed in the last legislative session. Back on page 36, there's the specified low-income Medicare beneficiary. We had a conversation just a few minutes ago about this group. These are the Medicare clients from 100% to 135% of the federal poverty level, and we pay their Part B premiums only. And finally, there's the medically needy benefit package. The medically needy program actually no longer exists, but it did exist up through the end of January of this year. The benefit package for that group was prescription drugs, chemical dependency services, mental health services, and transportation for those services. And there's been a small add-back since then of drug benefits for some of the clients who were formerly in this medically needy program, the HIV and the organ transplant clients. And that's been funded through June 30th of this year.
Mr. Britton.
And Jim, that add back was done through Senate Bill 5548.
Right. Moving to page 37, I'll talk for a little bit about the prioritized list of health services. There actually is going to be a little longer discussion of the Health Services Commission or by the Health Services Commission later on in the next few days, but we'll cover it briefly here. The Health Services Commission is an 11-member governor-appointed commission which administers, which initially developed and on an ongoing basis maintains Oregon's prioritized list of health services, the list that Oregon is nationally known for, either famously or infamously, depending on your point of view, but we are nationally known for it. The commission includes 5 physicians, 4 healthcare consumers, a social worker, and a public health nurse. The Health Service Commission originally developed a list ranked by clinical effectiveness, cost of treatment, and public values, and they are charged with updating this list every legislative session. An actuary then takes that list and determines the cost to provide the services. And after that, the legislature makes a decision on how much of the list to cover. The legislature essentially draws the line on the list.
Just so you know, members, that's PricewaterhouseCoopers. That does the actuarial.
Right. PricewaterhouseCoopers is the actuary that currently holds the contract to do that actuary pricing. Under current statute, the legislature draws the line on the list, but they cannot change the numerical order of the list. They have to draw the line somewhere on that list what will be covered. And it's also subject to federal approvals. So the line, when the legislature determines that they would like to move that line, we have to go forward for federal approval also. Some general criteria used to rank the services. Services which help prevent illness are higher on the list than those which treat illness after it occurs. Life-saving treatments tend to be very high on the list.
Can I pull back a little because there's an issue that's important, and that's the issue that's under statute that when once the numerical order and the list has been put together and has been adopted and accepted, then you cannot go back and rearrange the order of the list. That came up when we, in November, at the e-board, and there was a lot of discussion about that decision. And that was the basis of that decision. It is in statute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The services that tend to be high on the list are things such as life-saving treatments, maternity care, and preventive services. Services are lower on the list if they're for conditions that get better on their own or for which a home remedy is effective, things like the common cold. They're low on the list if they're primarily cosmetic in nature. They're low on the list if they have no effective treatment available. The list that we're currently operating under in the 2001-2003 biennium contains 736 lines, and the line is currently drawn at line 558. The revised list, which had been developed by the Health Services Commission for the 2003-2005 biennium, contains 730 lines. It's because of some reordering of the lines and some compression of the lines. And the equivalent coverage on that list to what's on this biennium's list would be at line 549. Moving now to the Oregon Health Plan standard benefit package. I'm on page 39 of the handout, and talk about some limitations and exclusions in the Oregon Health Plan standard benefit package. That's the package that went into effect February 1st when Oregon Health Plan 2 took effect. The primary limitation in that benefit package was the dental services limitation, which was a $500 maximum benefit per eligibility period per 6 months. In addition, there were some exclusions that took effect when that benefit package went into effect in February 1st. And some groups of services were no longer covered. Routine vision was no longer covered. Non-emergency medical transportation was no longer covered. Medical equipment and supplies to meet a one-time need was no longer covered. Hearing aids and hearing exams were no longer covered.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shield.
All of those make sense to me, except the one about crutches for a broken leg. You fix a broken leg, you don't give the person crutches? Is that... Maybe they break their leg again because you didn't get... I don't understand it.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, the decision was made by the Waiver Application Steering Committee, which developed that waiver application that went forward to the federal government, that there would be a limited benefit of the what's called the durable medical equipment. It's actually medical equipment and supplies. And at that point, they chose to cover the supplies portion of it, the things that are ongoing needs, but not to cover the one-time needs. And that includes the crutches. It also includes things like wheelchairs and beds. And I can't tell you for sure what all of the thought processes were that went into that, but there was a feeling by the majority of folks and by the managed care plans who I think put forward the proposal to cover it this way, that it was the appropriate thing to do to cut back on costs.
I was just wondering if it led to more costs.
I can only tell you that there was extensive discussion over a long period of time, and one of our members is shaking her head out there, a lot of discussion before this list was finally approved by the members of the committee.
And, Madam Chair, not only that, the revision that was just done on some of the lower numbers is actually going to allow us to move the line up. I think it also portends that we will be able to get fairly easy acceptance from
CMS with regard to that portion of our waiver amendment application, which at some juncture will be going back to D.C. or Baltimore. As long as Ellen Lowe's in the room, she should be acknowledged, and several others, for the hard work, not only in crafting the original list, but on the good work you did in revising it.
I guess I should, should put on the record that there are a number of citizens in the state who have contributed, as well as legislators, a lot of time and a lot of meetings that was done in order to get the waiver application, which was the basis of House Bill 2519, and get it back to Washington after our last session. Representative Bates was a part of that. I was a part of that. Mrs. Lowe, who's in the audience, there's just a lot, an awful lot of people who worked very, very hard who have been very supportive and really wanting to assure that we have health care for individuals in the state. And so I just, want to personally thank and staff, because when we have all these meetings and we're doing all of this planning and all this discussion, the staff is always there with us, too. So both the legislative as well as the executive staff are part of this process. And I guess I want to put that on record, because I think so often there are individuals who do not understand the amount of input that goes into the decisions that we ultimately make as policymakers. And also, I think there's some thought that perhaps we don't have a citizens' legislature in Oregon, and we do. We do encourage the citizens to be a part of what we're doing in this legislative process, and I just needed to state that today.
Madam Chair, just let me say, I wasn't challenging what you were saying. It was just, I always look at these things and I just say, we set out to save money, and you just want to make sure you're saving money. And when you, I assume you get a broken leg and you put a cast on it, you need crutches or you might break the leg again. And it just made sense to me to ask the question.
I don't
challenge what you're saying, and I do appreciate everything that the committee's doing. I don't get to sit in on all the wonderful meetings you have. I'm not sure I want to sit in on all the meetings.
We welcome you to sit
in. Yeah, I'm sure you would.
Wonderful meetings. But I also wanted to, and I do appreciate your question because I think it's a valid one. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to take the opportunity to thank all the individuals in this state who participates in this process and who participates without salary too. With Dr. Jackson and others in the state, and I think sometimes the general public does not really understand or have a clue at the amount of participation that we in Oregon encourage and want to continue this citizen legislature that we have, and the number of volunteers that we have, that if we did not have them, we could not do this job. And so I just wanted to say that I value the input of individuals who are here almost every day to assist us in the job that we do. So I just wanted to say thank you to them, and a couple of my good friends are sitting back there in the back. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Just picking up on Senator Shields' comment, though, the example of the crutches kind of jumped off the page at me, too. And it would be helpful to hear, not now, but later, or to receive later, an example of the cost associated with this kind of example. How many crutches could we possibly be talking about? And as the committee or folks were looking at what to keep and what to take off the list, what other options were explored for making crutches available. It seems simplistic, but it just, again, it jumps off the page at me, too.
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, yes, there were many difficult decisions made and much agonizing over how to reduce the cost of the standard benefit package. For one reason, was to get more flexibility into the program and make it more sustainable into the future. And I think we did get some sustainability into the future, but here we are 2 years later after the passage of House Bill 2519, seeing that we still don't have enough cost savings to make the program sustainable. So it wasn't enough. Moving to page 40, we have here some further cuts that were made March 1st of this year to further reduce the cost of the standard benefit package. Most of these were a result of some action taken by the November Emergency Board, the last one action taken as a result of the failure of the ballot measure. But March 1st, all dental services were eliminated from the standard benefit package. Also on March 1st, all outpatient mental health services, all outpatient chemical dependency services were eliminated, and all prescription drugs were eliminated for a period of time. Those were subsequently restored. So actually there was only about a two-week period when the folks in the standard benefit package went without prescription drugs, and we now have funding restored for drugs for that group through June 30th of this year, and then we're not sure what will happen at that point. The next page, page 41, is simply a summary of this standard benefit package in priority order, and you'll see in that top box the services that the federal government considers to be Medicaid mandatory benefits, which are benefits of the standard benefit package. It's the inpatient hospital, the outpatient hospital, emergency room, physician services, lab and x-ray, and ambulance services. Then in the next box is a group of services which the federal government does not mandate to be covered. They're considered optional services, and which in priority order are the ranking of these services by the Health Services Commission, and which were covered effective February 1, the highest being the prescription drugs, the next one being the mental health and chemical dependency services, then the medical equipment and supplies services, and the dental benefits. And those last three have been eliminated March 1 and have not been restored. So that's no longer a part of the benefit package. And finally, that next box, the vision, the non-emergency transportation, never were included in the standard benefit package. The next page, page 42, is a list of the standard benefit package co-payments. This, I think, is the co-payments that you were referring to a few minutes ago, Senator Morse. This was, again, an agonizing process of developing this list by the Waiver Application Steering Committee, designing the waiver application. It was designed to be similar to private insurance. That was one of the guiding principles used in designing this. And in most cases, they tried to set these copayments to be somewhere near 5% of the average value of the service. And if you look down this list, you see that they range anywhere from a high of $250 copayment for an inpatient hospital stay through $50 for emergency services, to $5 for an office visit, down to $2 and $3 for drugs. The drug copayments are actually tiered to $2 for a generic prescription, $3 for a mental health, cancer, or HIV brand name drug, and $15 for other brand name drugs.
Do we have any information back from the pharmacist? If I recall our discussion when we worked on this and came up with the copay structure, the one that was the most concern, if I can recall correctly, in addition to the hospitals, but was the pharmacist, and whether or not what success they've had in collection, non-collection, how much have they, do they think that has been collected? Do we have any information at all, Jeff?
We did some individual discussion with pharmacies soon after these copayments went into effect, and actually were surprised that in most cases clients were making the copayments and were not complaining about them, and there was not a huge problem. We had not done a statistically valid sampling, as far as I know. That was more anecdotal, but in those anecdotal discussions with pharmacies, we were pleasantly surprised that it didn't have a more negative impact than it had at that point.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
To follow up on your question and Senator Morris's question, because I don't know the answer to this one, what's been the experience, even anecdotally, of the other copays? My expectation that my office is not unusual and that we've collected that much difficulty at the time of the visit, but the lab and x-ray and been a real question. We didn't even know how much to correct. I mean, what do you consider a lab? One test, five tests, a group of tests? The test that day, it was really a mass confusion for a while, and I think we've pretty well given up trying to collect it. But what's been the experience across the state?
I don't know if we've had any summary experience on that. I don't think we've done any even anecdotal on that. But we can ask around and see if we can get a little bit of quick information for you if you'd like.
It would be interesting to note, if there are where the problem areas, because I think that if the labs and the x-rays and what have you becomes the problem area, I think we need to know that, if that's creating some problems out there in the system. If the dentist or the pharmacist aren't having problems, I think we need to know that. It's just a cost shift issue that I think we need to put both discussions, or either it isn't for a discussion because things are working okay or it's not working okay.
Just one comment for Representative Bates. We did finally implement these copayments as one copayment per procedure, per provider, per day. So a number of copayments would not stack up to a number of lab tests in one setting, one day, would not stack up to a large number of copayments stacked on top of one another. It was intended to be one per day. On the next page, page 43, we'll talk for just a minute about premium levels. Under Oregon Health Plan 2, the premiums were restructured. They are higher than they previously had been, and they are mandatory premiums, and premiums not paid will result in disenrollment from the program and a required unenrollment from the program for a period of 6 months. You can ignore the four bottom boxes because we haven't gone above 100% of the federal poverty level in this population group. So the range of premiums that we're charging is from $6 to $20 for these five bands of the federal poverty level. And as Lynn mentioned a few minutes ago, the 0 to 10% of the federal poverty level is by far the largest band, so the largest group of people are paying a $6 per month premium.
Madam Chair.
President Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's been the percentage of people paying that premium or failing to pay the premium?
We just experienced our first cutoff date based on people who did not pay the premium in February, had a grace period through the 25th of March, and the cutoff date would have been the 25th of March. We actually discovered as we got close to the 25th of March that there was quite a bit of confusion on the part of clients about how to pay those premiums, where to pay those premiums. There were attempts to pay them in person, and it had been set up entirely as a mail-in payment system. There were some administrative problems with whether the address was included on the bill in all cases. There was always a return address envelope in the packet, but apparently some of the billings went out without a return address. And we finally made a decision to delay the consequences of this by 1 month. So there will not actually be a disenrollment for failure to pay premiums until the end of this current month. Anyone who did not make their payment for February or March will be disenrolled at the end of April. And what we would have disenrolled if we had done it would have been about 15,000 clients out of our 100,000 clients if we had done it at the beginning of this month.
Go ahead and follow up, and then I'll put this in.
When we bill patients, it costs us anywhere from $3 to $5 to send a bill out and get it back again. What's the cost to send the bill out? I'm not just talking mailing. I'm not talking about whatever it costs to have someone do that, pay them an hourly wage,
mail
it and get it back.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we do contract that out, and so that'll be captured in our contracting costs. On a per billing basis, and that'll include the I don't have the number for you right now, but can get it. It'll be the cost that of sending out the notices, of doing the accounting, receipting the money as it comes in, because it comes into the vendor, and so we'll capture that entire cost and get it and provide that to you.
Was that the question
that
you were going to ask?
That question.
Included in, and even though it's contracted out to the vendor, is there also included when you cap that the administrative cost of the action that happens at the state level? Because just because managed down here, there's also some programmatic things that happen up at this level. So is that included as well?
Madam Chair, that would not be included in the information that's readily available. Okay. We'd need to try and identify something for that.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. We'll move on to page 44 of the handout now and talk a little bit about delivery systems. There are two major types of delivery systems. One of them is the managed care system, where there's a capitated risk-based arrangement with contracted managed care plans, and the other is a fee-for-service delivery system, a system of individual medical providers billing the Office of Medical Assistance programs directly for provided services.
Is there somewhere in this packet some graphs that gives us the percentage of each?
Do we have that in here?
What percentage do we have in managed care, and how much are in fee-for-service over there? Number of clients that are in each?
Madam Chair, when Judy Moore Peterson joins us, that's one of our performance measures, is related to the percent enrolled in managed care, and so we will get to that issue then.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will you or will we be covering at some point the administrative costs of the fee for service as a percentage of revenue collected?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, yes, we're going to get into some budget information, including administrative costs, a little later in the presentation.
Okay.
Although I would like to clarify on that, we do have some components in this handout that talk about the administrative functions, but the administrative budget itself is not a part of OMAP's budget. That is part of the Health Services Central Administrative Services budget, and so I don't believe that's been addressed yet, and that's where the actual budget component will be addressed, is for health services.
Yeah, I've looked at that, and it's not particularly comforting, Madam Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Well, when they come before us, we'll see how uncomfortable you can make them.
Okay. I can get comfortable.
Moving to page 45, there are five major types of managed care. There's the fully capitated health plans, which provide physical health services and chemical dependency services. There's the dental care organizations, which provide preventive dental care, dental restoration, and repair of dentures. There's the mental health organizations, which provide outpatient mental health services and acute inpatient mental health services. There's the chemical dependency organizations, which provide outpatient chemical dependency services. And there's a program called Primary Care Case Managers. This is a coordination and management of care for a fee, and I think the current rate is $6 per month per client for someone to provide this coordination and management of care. These individuals or groups also provide primary care services. And this type of system is generally used when it's needed to facilitate access and coordination of care, often in an area where there is not a managed care plan. We currently have 844 primary care case managers and a little over 10,000 clients enrolled.
How many clients?
A little over 10,000, 10,089. And there's a list here of types of providers that can be primary care case managers. We'll talk on page 47 about the difference between mandatory and optional enrollment. In managed care, there can be either mandatory or optional enrollment, and it depends in large part on where the client lives and the type of managed care that's available in the area. When the plans have the capacity to serve all eligibles, then they are required to enroll, and there is mandatory enrollment. Generally, when a client is enrolled in one type of plan, they're enrolled in the others too. So they're involved in a fully capitated health plan, a dental care organization, and a mental health organization.
Who makes those determinations?
Those determinations are made by OMAP, by the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, based on the availability of managed care in a county or in a geographic area. And if there is access through the managed care plans, that's the preferred method of providing the care, and then there would be managed care enrollment, except for a few groups that are excluded from a requirement for managed care, such as Native Americans.
Madam Chair.
Rep. Fabry.
Representative Wessler may want to speak to this more. This has been a major glitch for the program, one we're working on in the Audit Committee under Representative Wessler's leadership. The eligibility is done by AFS, and quite often the decision is made to send patients away from managed care into fee-for-service because they felt that was best for the patient or the individual, or for whatever reason we can't understand. The Audit Committee really feels, I think I can speak pretty bluntly here, managed care is by far the most efficient and better way to go. It's better for the patient in the long run for access, and it's better for the state in the long run financially. That decision has pretty well been looked at, decided, and reached, I think, in that committee. One of the problems we still face, though, is we have a large number of people in the counties where they have managed care available not going into managed care because the workers are sending them in a different direction. So just to clear that, that's an issue we want to deal with and talk about more, but probably not at this moment. But I want to make that point before we go any further.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, that's true. OMAP does not do eligibility determination. That's done in the field. And it's the Community Human Services Program primarily where that function resides. And there's eligibility determination not just for the Oregon Health Plan, but I think for 20 different types of social services programs done by those workers who do eligibility determination, and it's not an OMAP function.
But at some point, where does OMAP come into the decision-making points?
If I could speak to that issue for a few minutes. First, we approach it from a systematic perspective, and so we look in a given geographic area and say, do we have managed care plans participating who have capacity to serve the population in that area? And the managed care plans themselves provide us with the information in terms of what their capacity is, and they do this on a periodic basis. And if we have enough plans with capacity to serve the population in the area, then we would make the enrollment in managed care mandatory for that area. then from there it falls to the field structure, the eligibility workers, in order to carry out that mandatory enrollment activity. And it is possible for exceptions to be made, for example, for continuity of care reasons, as Jim had mentioned, American Indians, Alaska Natives can be exempt from managed care enrollment. A woman who's just joining the health plan for the first time in her third trimester of pregnancy, and if her physician isn't participating in the managed care plan or her provider, we'd allow to be exempt during that time period to continue with her prenatal care and delivery. But there are, different levels of compliance in terms of or flexibility used by field staff in terms of determining whether or not someone should be exempted from enrollment in managed care.
Lynn, do you provide them with the guidelines for those exceptions?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. And we do have them in administrative rule that talks about the whole enrollment issue. We also have done periodically a focus on those areas where managed care is mandatory because there's enough capacity identified to do reports and follow up, sending the reports out to the field to managers. In terms of looking to see, are these valid exceptions? Why is your particular area a lower participation rate? But what we found has happened over the years, and Judy will talk more to what the experience of managed care has been over the time period of the Oregon Health Plan. But the capacity of the plans has diminished. And so there are areas of the state that used to be mandatory that are optional. One striking example of that is the Portland metropolitan area, although we have just made it mandatory again because of capacity has been identified to allow us to do that. But for quite some time, the Portland area has not been mandatory. When an area is optional, then it truly is a matter of choice. There isn't enough capacity to serve everyone, so we can't mandate clients locked into a managed care plan. And that's where you'll see more of this counseling that may occur in a field office where they may say, for whatever reason, they might counsel an individual. But we also have recognized that that's a very important issue to take on and want to work with the plans in terms of ensuring that we have capacity so that we can make managed care mandatory.
So capacity is a huge issue.
Yes, it is, ma'am. And Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll move on. Beginning on page 48, the next few pages are maps of the state of Oregon showing counties where there is at least some managed care capacity and counties where there is none. The first map on page 48 is the fully capitated health plans. There are five counties with no managed care capacity at all, and the rest of them have at least some. There are
six.
Sorry. I stand corrected. And the next map is the map of the dental care organizations, where there is at least some coverage throughout the state. And the next map is the mental health organizations. Moving to page 51, I'll talk briefly about the fee-for-service delivery system. These are clients who are not enrolled in managed care, and clients can go to any provider who is willing to accept a medical ID card issued by...
Consider the open card.
This is what's called the open card. Yes, Madam Chair.
I just want to be familiar with the terminology that's being used. So if someone calls their office, they know what they're talking about.
Exactly. Thank you. And then on page 52 is a summary of the payment systems. Services provided through managed care are reimbursed using rates based on a reasonable cost of providing services. And that phrase is actually in statute. The rates are set by a contracted independent actuary. The providers are paid by capitation, Managed care plans are paid a set amount per enrolled member per month. Physical health, mental health, dental, chemical dependency services are all available through this model. And then the other primary model is the fee-for-service model, where providers bill us directly and they're paid at traditional Medicaid rates. Those rates are adjusted by legislative-approved inflation factors during legislative sessions. And there's also the requirement that providers must accept the reimbursement rates from Medicaid as payment in full, and they cannot bill a client for a balance due after Medicaid pays their section, their part. That's the end of the section I'm going to present on, so I'll hand it back over to Lynn.
Thank you. At this point on page 53, I was going to start talking about some of the cost drivers for the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid and some of the cost containment measures that have put in that we have put in place and briefly touch on some of the administrative services that we provide. And after that, we'll be talking, bringing up Judy Moore Peterson, and that may very well be the next day's session, but I'll see how far I could get in this lead-in to what Judy will be talking about. On page 53, of course, the number one cost driver for us is inflation, medical inflation, dealing with utilization, the amount of services used, what the unit price is for those services, and then the reflection of advances in treatment protocols and medical technology. You know, I just might note right here that this issue of medical inflation plagues the private sector. Certainly the Oregon Health Plan doesn't drive that issue. We respond to it just like the private sector does. To give you some perspective on how that issue is before the private sector, looking at the Public Employees Benefit Board benefit packages, in 2002, those rates went up by 26%. In 2003, it was projected to be 8.74% increase. And then there is information out there for 2004 and beyond in terms of industry projections that we're going to continue to see double-digit increases of 10 to 15% a year. And so that's one of the issues that we're trying to contain in some fashion within the Medicaid program and the Oregon Health Plan. And just to highlight a couple of the services that are have seen a significant cost increases, those would be drug costs and hospital costs. In recent years, hospital costs are growing quite rapidly. Also impacting our costs, of course, are the caseload, and particularly as you have a bad economic time, at the very time when you have less money to put to this program, you see more individuals who are in need of services from the program. And then the mix of those eligibles, if you have people with more difficult medical needs, that changes the cost of the program. Also, state and federal policy changes impact the program. You know, some of the choices that you make in terms of any expansions, which isn't generally an issue, at least not this time around for us. But cost-based reimbursement, Type A and Type B hospitals have a statutory protection to cost-based reimbursement, so it has a natural inflator in those costs. The federal government does things like federally qualified health centers and rural health clinics. We're required to do cost-based reimbursement, and that's a federal requirement for those providers. When we implemented the Children's Health Insurance Program, one of the federal requirements that come along with that is doing outreach. And when you do outreach for children, what we've found is that you also outreach to other individuals who would be eligible for your regular programs. And so you see an increase in caseload from that. Obviously, the health status of the general population would carry over into the Medicaid program as well, and perhaps you might see it exacerbated in the Medicaid program. The aging population, more and more Oregonians are over age 85, and that's when we start to see some really significant health care costs. We spent a little bit of time talking about the managed care delivery system, and we found that, generally speaking, the managed care delivery system does not cost as much as the fee-for-service delivery system, and so as we lose managed care in various areas or don't have enough capacity and we see clients move into fee-for-service, we see a growth in costs.
Lynn, anecdotal, you hear that that the more severe clients are in fee-for-service more so than in managed care, that there has been some cherry-picking. And I just need to know if that's accurate or is that just anecdotal?
Madam Chair, it's a difficult issue to get to, and I can't answer it definitively. Judy Moore Peterson is just wrapping up a study that's been done that we're going to be providing to various. Well, it started with Representative Bates' request to look at that issue of managed care and fee for service, and we started off comparing Jackson and Josephine counties, thinking that we could do it in a very localized area where you had managed care that was working very well in Josephine County, and you had Jackson County, which at one point in time had full managed care participation but now has a very limited participation, and do some comparisons. We ran into troubles with that analysis because of small numbers, although it was indicating that managed care was less expensive. So Judy's staff moved to look at it from a statewide perspective, and what they have found, the findings from that that'll soon be released, they've identified that as one of the issues that they don't have enough information on to know if that is the particular driver. There are many drivers that impact both sides. For example, on the managed care side, our capitation rates are based on factors that represent reasonable cost, whereas on the fee-for-service side, they're not intended to do that, except for certain protected service groups. I believe in the most recent year of the data analysis that Judy's staff have done, it showed fee-for-service to be about 8% higher than managed care. And that's been what we've observed over the years. And, of course, we get additional benefits from managed care that we strongly support in terms of the coordination of benefits and access to care. The last bullet on this page is that the system capacity and the accessibility of providers also impacts costs. When you have physician shortage areas or growing shortages in nurses, pharmacists, those all can have an impact on cost as well as access. Some of the cost containment measures that we've put in place over the years, many directed by the legislature, we've categorized them in these next few pages. On page 54, these are cost containment items directed at tightening eligibility for the health plan to ensure that the resources are spent on those people with the greatest need. And so back in October of 95, about a year and a half into the program, a couple of changes were made to the program. One was to, instead of looking at the month a person was applying for assistance and what their income was that month, was to look at 3 months' worth of income to get a better sense of someone who has an ongoing low-income individual.
How well is that working? And I ask that because I received some information from a physician who shared with me that there was a person who had enough money to have an in vitro and who was having triplets, and we're paying for the triplets. And so, you know, it begs the question, if one has enough money to pay for that kind of a very costly implantation, how then did that person end up getting on the Oregon Health Plan?
Madam Chair, there are anecdotes such as that that indicate.
I don't believe this was anecdotal.
But no, I don't mean to imply that it wasn't the case. I meant that it wasn't a data driven analysis, and there are some quality control studies that have been done looking at error rates. And generally what you'll find in terms of error rates, it is an issue of whether or not all of the income has been reported. Now, that may or may not be an issue of fraud, but obviously the intent is to only focus the benefits since we have limited funds available at those who truly are eligible. And over the years, there have been some other things. Well, the very third bullet down was the enhanced residency and income verification process we put in place to try and get at that, to start looking at some of the tools that were available to us, readily available to us, like child support screens. Did somebody have income from child support? Unemployment screens. Or wages. There is wage information that we can access through the Department of Employment. However, that isn't timely to the time at which someone is applying.
How much
assistance.
Time does it take us to get the information from the Employment Division?
I'm thinking that can range from 3 to 6 months, so that it's fairly old for determining because it's reported, I believe, quarterly. And so
from the employer, yes, it is. We report quarterly. You're right.
Okay. Now, there are some other services out there. And one of the things.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I need a little health plan 101. Actually, let me first a request, then a question. Would it be possible for me to get a copy of an application for the health plan as if I was coming through the door?
Yeah, for the whole plan.
Yes, we'll do that.
And then the question I have, the 101 question I have is, when you're determining income eligibility, does a pension, a 401k, if someone had a large amount in a 401k, but their day-to-day income is nominal, does that make them eligible for the plan?
I am, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. I'm going to have to talk to the eligibility part of our agency to get an answer to that. Generally speaking, what they look at in terms of income is cash, income that interest, CDs, what they call liquid. Well, some of it, there's liquid assets. There's an asset test as well as an income test. And so I'll have somebody answer that question.
But why don't we have someone from Adult and Family Services who actually does eligibility determination to come in and walk us through the form. I think that would be helpful. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, and maybe this question will be addressed at that time, but why do we disconnect the eligibility process from the payment process? What was the rationale for doing that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the eligibility for the Medicaid program from the beginning has been because you fell in certain categories. And so usually what would happen is that somebody would be applying for temporary assistance to needy families. They're applying for cash assistance or assistance with jobs, applying for daycare, applying for food stamps. And along with eligibility for those programs, they get Medicaid eligibility. And so that was done out in the field. When we implemented the Oregon Health Plan, we said we wanted to make this an easy process for Oregonians who have income below 100% of poverty. We want to make it a simple application, which is not what it was when it started. We want to make it a simple application. We want it to be mail-in. And so then we had some opportunities there to make a choice on whether or not we wanted to do that in the branch offices or if we wanted to separate it from the other kinds of eligibility determinations that go on out in the field. Ultimately, we decided to centralize it, although we did it in the agency that has expertise in doing eligibility, which was Adult and Family Services at that point. And so there's the central OHP processing center that handles mail-in applications. But what we find is that many of those individuals also have to be screened for other programs as well. And so, once again, the public assistance eligibility programs are very complex. Jim mentioned about 20 different programs that you may have to be screening for. And it was felt that the expertise should be there, and that instead what OMAP would continue doing is administering the benefits. Once you're determined eligible, then we're responsible for what are the benefits that you receive and the payment for those benefits and the delivery system. But there are different ways it could be organized.
I think what you know, rather than have two eligibility systems, it was decided that one eligibility system, since most of the individuals that come in through human services would come in through that mm-hmm. pathway. And then you're not setting up separate eligibility systems, did I?
Yes.
And, Madam Chair, may I add to that that let's be 12 or 15 years ago, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs actually was a part of the Adult and Family Services Division. Previous to that, the Public Welfare Program. But with the growth of health care costs and the impact of those costs across the department, the decision was made in the late 80s, I believe, mm-hmm. to put the Office of Medical Assistance Programs in the director's office. And since that time, it's become integrated with health services. Health services doesn't have a field. We don't do that work ourselves. We're benefit managers, and we have a field which is contracted. We make special payments. The field branch for the department, CHS, Community Human Services, I'll make my payment, is in the process of actually integrating its social casework. So it's a matter of how we want to bring services to the public versus how Lynn Reed and her staff manage the benefit process.
And clearly part of the, I mean, not part of it, the principles and mission of the reorganization, the bill that we passed last session, is to try to, as much as possible, to reduce as much as possible the duplication, and also to reduce as much as possible the recipients, if you will, having to go through many doors before they get the service. And so that's also another reason why you're having the common eligibility determination happening in human services. It's trying to eliminate all of the multiple doors that one has to go through. So if you had eligibility over here for OMAP in one part of the system, and then you had adult and family services in another part that they're having to go to, then adult and family services, who traditionally sees the majority of the individuals who come in, would have to then refer them over. And it was trying to eliminate these kinds of referrals to happen in the system. The same would be true with some of the other aspects that go on in human services.
Well, Madam Chair, if I ask a question, a few moments ago we talked about bringing in the eligibility materials, and somebody from that branch of the department, the field branch of the department, to explain that. You'd like to have us do that next week.
Would you do that? Because I think it would be helpful. We get a lot of questions, both from the public surrounding eligibility, and I think it would just be helpful to have a walkthrough to understand what's all encompassed when we say eligibility and just what the staff does. And so I think if you've got an application here before you, you can walk through. And, of course, another way is that you can go be a client for a day and go out to one of the branches and sign up.
Madam Chair, I would actually like Madam Chair to do that, and I may just go do that.
Yeah. Are just, fraud penalty?
on a legislative salary.
You know, we have had, where legislators have been, and I think it's under which one of the programs that actually you may get invited to be a client for the day, or to have actually clients who you partner with that are in our system. I think it's if you haven't signed up for it and you get invited, I would encourage you to do so. It's enlightening. You get a better understanding of what and why the systems exist. You also are able to walk in somebody else's shoes.
That's right.
And so you may just want to have those little experiences.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, Liz.
Perhaps I can just finish up with this page, and then when we return next week, talk about the balance of the cost containment measures. I did mention that there is a liquid asset limitation. There wasn't when we started the health plan, but we implemented one in October of 95. Then at legislative direction, we further reduced that asset limit in January of 2000 to $2,000. With the advent of OHP2 in February of this year, there were some additional eligibility criteria in terms of tightening that door. We're able to put a cap on eligibles above 100% of federal poverty level were we to expand above 100% of federal poverty level. We now require that someone who comes into the OHP standard benefit package be uninsured for 6 months before they would be eligible. We also, there's another item that wasn't on here I need to add. We've also required that those OHP standard clients, if they have employer-sponsored coverage available to them, need to go over to the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and they can receive a subsidy there in order to participate in their employer-sponsored coverage. And the other item I would mention here is that I failed to list on here is that on March 1st, we did implement another component to the eligibility, and that was that eligibility would be for these clients effective following the month following eligibility determination instead of a retroactive eligibility. And we did talk about that the other day.
That has huge implications. The hospitals don't particularly are very fond of that particular
rule.
Right.
And if it suits you, I will stop there.
I think that we're at 3 o'clock unless there's further questions. If not, we are adjourned until Monday.